Good. So what I wanted to do first is get my transparencies wet. Second is try to bring an old topic back into, I'm assuming people don't know about what I'm talking about, that there aren't many experts in the audience, so that I'll start from, you know, sort of cosmic rays has been a field that sort of started a lot of particle physics. You know, you had all kinds of experiments done with the accelerator up there, which is, you know, there are particles coming through, and you can put a detector, and that's how the whole thing began, by looking at, actually, let me backtrack for a second for the history part, which is that the way cosmic rays were discovered were by looking at things that ionize too fast. Okay, so there are reasons to believe in a closed container that something would keep their charge for any element you charged up, would stay charged for a while, and it kept uncharging too quickly until they figured that this was something else coming through your equipment. And people did very interesting physics trying to understand what these rays were. And it turns out that if you put a cosmic ray detector here, there's going to be a lot of cosmic rays coming from the Earth. So those are not what we call cosmic rays. And to really understand that they were cosmic, you had to raise your detector above some altitude when the flux starts decreasing because the ground level contamination disappears, and then you start increasing again. And by the time you get to know that there is an increase, you faint. So these were very courageous physicists that learned these things were happening. So now we know that there are lots of cosmic rays. And, you know, usually, I will show you why, they are interesting but not as exciting as the highest energy ones are. So for me, I got into this business because of the highest energy cosmic rays, which have an interesting puzzle associated with them. And I hope to make at least a puzzle clear, if not some of the theories that try to solve it. So as I mentioned, cosmic rays were discovered in 1912 by Victor Hess after work of other people, like Wilson and others. And they range a huge range in energy. We have cosmic rays from GeV, so let me show you the spectrum. And for any astronomer in the audience, this is the most boring spectrum you could possibly have. There's nothing aside from a really nice power law, which is basically an e^-3 power law, and seems to be maybe a little feature here at the knee. But you can see that it ranges from GeVs all the way to 10^20 electron volts. The graph goes to 21. We are hopeful that there will be events over there too. And the flux is diving with e^-3. So you have, you know, for example, at the highest energies, which is what I'll be focusing on, one particle per kilometer squared per century. So that's pretty low as far as detecting them. There's something really nice about particles. It's speculated upon, let's put it that way. So let me tell you what is known. So in a second. So the nice thing about these very high energy ones is that if you really were supposed to catch one at a time, it would take you forever to get any. But after some energy, the atmosphere makes it into a calorimetry experiment. So the particle comes in and spreads and makes a shower and makes more and more particles. So by having a ground array, for example, you can discover that there are extensive air showers. And these extensive air showers are what are used to detect the higher energy end of the spectrum, the second half of what I showed you, from the knee on. And maybe there's a feature called the knee. This change, maybe you can hardly see it if I didn't point it out to you. But there is a little, I'm putting this, let me take this out. But there, the data is too sketchy here, but there's a small deviation from the E cubed over here. So this is e^-2.7 or so. And it goes to e^-3. Okay. Now, and the detectors that go to the highest energies have two types, ground arrays and fluorescence detectors, and I'll talk about them for a second. But let me go back to the mundane cosmic rays. So that most of the time, all these cosmic rays up to the knee, say, so this range over here, are thought to be accelerated through Fermi acceleration in supernovae remnants. Okay, so this is the plan. But the problem is, in astronomy, you look at a photon, it's coming from the direction that you see it arriving from. But a proton at these energies goes around the magnetic field of the galaxy and loses complete notion of where it came from. At least we have no clue. And it's very hard to really pin down the acceleration site for these things. So we're still trying to find, for example, photons from pion decay at the acceleration site. So the idea is that all this is done by supernovae remnants, but it's not really proven in terms of observations, and that there is a band that people associate maybe with starting to leak out of the galaxy. Okay, so when you get to higher and higher energies, you turn around the galactic magnetic field less and less. You have more and more gyre radius every time, so eventually you lose these guys. So the ones over here, we expected to be extragalactic, not to even come from the galaxy. Actually, we expected them not to be there, which is the fun part. So this topic is sort of complementary to dark matter. Dark matter is something we think is there, and we don't find it, and these cosmic rays we thought shouldn't be there, and they seem to be. So today, the largest ground array is this one, which you can't see. You can see some blue things, which are stations where they access the ground array, which is on the ground. And this is in Japan called the Agassiz Array, and I'll be showing data from that. And in an array, it's pretty obvious what happens. You have a shower, it hits the ground, you have spread, you know, detectors in different parts of, you know, this is in meters, 2,000 meters, and so forth. And you detect a bunch of particles per detector, and you know what happened, you know, when they all arrive sort of together, what kind of energies this whole shower looked like. So if you want a sort of combined picture, this is what you expect. Some shower that develops in the atmosphere and the footprint of that shower when it hits the ground. It's the amount of particles per tank. So the one in the center has 24,000 particles, and then it dies off to 70s and so forth to a few. The shower, so what happens, this is a simulation of a proton shower at 10 to the 19. Yeah, we can't see this, but we can get close with the other techniques. So I showed you there were two techniques, ground arrays, but maybe I went too fast on that one here. So ground arrays has a huge history back to the 60s with Volcano Ranch for the highest energies. And then you have Agassiz, which is 170 kilometers square. We're now building a much, much bigger array. And then there's fluorescence detectors, which I find very neat. The first one was Fly's Eye, and now high resolution Fly's Eye. And what they do is a clever idea that when the shower is developing in the atmosphere, there is an excitation of the nitrogen molecules in the air, so you can see fluorescence from it. So if you put a bunch of photomultipliers tubes with nice mirrors in trash cans on top of a mountain in, say, Utah, then what you get from time to time is the signature of a shower developing in the atmosphere. You also get all kinds of other things like jets and so forth. But let me show you what a signal of a shower would look like here. So if you look at all these trash cans here, they had detectors that saw showers like this developing in the atmosphere. So you actually see it on the sky. Okay? And this is just the number of photons per detector in some area given, you know, sort of this is one area of detecting the other, and you know, they actually make this is broken because the projected geometry of the detector is like a fly's eye. That's why it's called fly's eye. And here's how it would look. It's like a sphere with all these tubes catching pieces of the shower. Some catch twice and so forth, two pieces of it. And now they improved it quite a bit, and they're doing it in garages instead of trash cans with beautiful mirrors that then focus all the nitrogen fluorescence photons. So you can see showers, and the really sort of hope is to use a lot of what's called the stereo high res, which is two mountains in Dugway area, that's if you have a shower developing here, you can see the two tracks on one side and the other, and then know exactly how the shower developed. Because when you see just one, when you have monocular eyes, you know a plane where it came from, but you don't know exactly where it was. So with two planes, you can get the whole story. So that's how we're the situation right now. But this fly's eye, back in 91, saw an event like this. Okay, this event is the following. A number of particles, so this is again in the atmosphere how it develops, number of particles per billion, so 50 billion, 100 billion, and so forth. Depth in the atmosphere, grams per centimeter squared. And this is, you know, going up and dying and then hitting the ground down here. So there's a development of the shower. It has an electromagnetic, there's a hadronic part, which in that picture of the simulation is the pink core of the shower, and you hardly ever get that. And then you have electromagnetic and a muon part, which comes from the pions. So you pile all this stuff up, and you integrate what the energy you would need to make a shower like this, and you get something like 3 times 10 to the 20 electron volts. So this was a big surprise. there was a big surprise that we found 3 × 10^20 electron volt event in FlySci. Sorry? About 20% is the experimental quote, but people argue it might be bigger than that, but that's about reasonable. And then, so this is the record holder from FlySci. FlySci has not been operating since, so you know we have not new data from it. But AGASSA has operated from 92 to last year, and still operating. And it has 8 events above 10^20, 728 events above 10^19. High-resolution FlySci is still analyzing stereo data, but the mono data seems to show about 7 above 10^20. In Harvard Park and Volcano Ranch had seen a few, but since these were all ground arrays, you didn't really have much confidence that these were exactly what you thought they were. And the reason that this is a big surprise is that there's no GZK cutoff. So GZK stands for Grisons at Zeppelin-Cushman, who back in 66, when the microwave background was discovered, proposed that there should be a cutoff to the cosmic ray spectrum. Okay, so how does that work? That's kind of obvious. But let's go through the steps to make sure you're with me on this one. So you have a galaxy like ours with a magnetic field of about microgauss, say a few microgauss. So the gyre radius for protons, and we're assuming these things are protons. Okay, we'll discuss the fact that they might be other things later. If they are a proton, when you reach, say, 7 × 10^19, the gyre radius is shown here in green, which means the gyre radius is larger than the scales in the galaxy. So you don't expect it to be diffusing around the galaxy, but comes sort of straight at you, right? So if that's what you expect from protons, you could see from this plot that if it's iron, then the story is a little bit different. But if, it's okay.
It's okay.
Unless I'm in front of anybody, but I guess I could use. So iron at Z26 is, the Z is the one that we care most about. So iron is already sort of turning around within. So from this picture, iron would be trapped. Depending on how you define trapped, right? So oxygen is sort of the distance between us and the center of the galaxy. And as you see, one of the big debates is how far, how strong is the field when you move away from the plane? We know the field very well in the plane of the galaxy. But, you know, maybe it is coming from the galaxy, but it's coming straight. It's not turning around. So what we should do is look at which direction they're coming from, because now, finally, you should be able to do astronomy, right? So now these guys are so energetic, their gyre radius is so large, that you should be able to point back. So you plot where they're coming from. This is in galactic coordinates, and this is the region that AGASSA sees over here. So we don't see any of, there's no data in the southern hemisphere. And cosmic ray folks turn the galactic center here because there is no data in the southern hemisphere where the galactic center is. And if you look at the data points, they're spread pretty isotropically to first approximation. There's a little bit of clustering. There's a triplet here and a triplet there. And these are all at 5 × 10^19 and above. Okay. So because they look like this and not like that, they are probably not coming from the galaxy if they're protons, right? Okay, no problem. They're extragalactic. Big deal. There's galaxies all over the place accelerating these things. Yeah, but then there's this guy on the way. Right? So these things are microwave photons, which are, for us, very low energy photons. But for a 10^20 electron volt proton, these are gamma rays. Right? So now you have a gamma of 10^11, and you look at this background, and you make pions like crazy. Right? When you reach above 10^20, around 10^20, you start producing pions and lose energy very quickly. So here's your proton coming from extragalactic distances, interacting with the microwave background, making pions, and losing energy efficiently. So here's, for example, what would happen to a 10^20 electron volt loses energy. So there's, just backstepping 1 second, there's always going to be energy losses, right? So there's always going to be some loss of energy because there are electromagnetic interactions. The difference here is that there's a threshold. There's a pion mass, right? So before, you would lose energy. So if you put a spectrum of particles any place, by the time it gets here, it lost some energy. But the whole spectrum sort of loses it together to some level. You might bend it a little bit. But there's no kinks and wiggles and stuff. But if you have a pion mass, then suddenly it turned on. That's why you have not only the 10^20 lose some energy, but the 21 and the 22, they all go down to 10^20. They all go below the pion mass very quickly. Okay, and the kind of scales we're talking about is 30 megaparsecs, 50 megaparsecs, which compared to our galaxy is big, but compared to cosmology is really tiny. Okay, so we should be able to know where they're coming from if they're coming from 30 to 50 megaparsecs only. Now, so the story is, we expected one thing, we found another, and I'm going to do something to you. We took that whole cosmic ray power spectrum that looked like an e to the minus 3. So at the end, the very end, let's multiply it by e cubed so we get a straight line. So here is now the same power spectrum I showed you before, but now I'm starting at 10 to the 18, going to a little bit past 10 to the 20, and it's a straight line, the end of the spectrum, and this is the blue dotted thing is what we expected would happen, okay? That when you reach the threshold, there would be a pile-up, because stuff that was above 10 to the 20 by the time it got here is at 10 to the 19, so you pile up more 10 to the 19, and then, you know, go away. And there you go. There are all these other guys over here. There aren't too many. You can say, well, there are only 8. Maybe if there are errors in the energies, they're all going to be shifted over.
Where are 5, 7,
8? No, this is total events.
Oh, these,
so what the question is, what happened here in this bin? Yeah, so here's a log scale, and if it's the same 20%, then you don't really get away with it, right? I mean, they're still on this side of it. So there are many questions. One is the data right or wrong? And I think, you know, I'm not the best person to answer that one, because I'm a theorist. But, you know, it is scary because it is an E cubed power law, so you have, you know, the edge could spill over. But on the other hand...
You know, when people in this field are doing these calculations, mm-hmm. they're calculated with blue curves, they worry, obviously, the red data point is the big discrepancy.
Right.
But do they worry about the little discrepancy on the left side?
Yeah, actually, that blue, I'll talk about this blue dot dashed line and take it apart in a few minutes, yeah,
so
a second, hopefully, yes. Mm-hmm.
Are the red data points colored differently just because of the
Exactly. No, it's the same experiment, the whole thing.
Are we sure that the primaries are not photon?
Not as much as we should be. I'll talk about this in a second. If I don't, please... So let me talk about this now. Okay. So the composition. The composition is a hard thing to measure, right? Because you're seeing a shower, and whatever came in will make a shower. A photon will give you a different shower than a proton and an iron because it's not a hadron. So first, the interaction points are different. So some will interact deeper, and some will interact shallower in the atmosphere. And the amount of hadrons you will produce if you start with a photon is different than if you start with a proton. So in principle, we should be able, if we measure it really well, and if we simulate everything really well, which is the big question here too, we should be able to tell them apart. Now, there's a good news because photons, in principle, if you have enough data, you could use things like the magnetic field of the Earth to look in different directions. But with 8 events, forget it. But, you know, that's the plan. So eventually, I think we should be able to tell the composition if we have enough events. But right now, it's a little bit tough. The events that fly's eye saw, because they see then the development, the whole thing, you can tag a little bit better from the shower development, because you know the interaction point, how the shower peaked, and so forth. So those events that you have the whole development are much easier than these events, which are all in the ground. So in the ground, the hope was to look at muons. So they put a lot of muon detectors in between these other just particle detectors, which detect everything that goes through. And those are not very conclusive. That's the situation right now, especially when you do comparison of proton and iron. Now, if you do simulations of proton and iron showers, there is a very different peak when you make a lot of them. But the fluctuations between one shower and the next are huge because, you know, you have the mean interaction point, but they can interact much lower or much higher, and it's an exponential atmosphere. It's easy to, you know, tag one when you have a lot, but when you have one or two, you can't really tell. Yeah, so more muons for more hadronic showers. That's the general rule. But I think the situation right now is we don't have the experiments that would tell them apart.
So photons are not attenuated by the
field. Right. They're attenuated by other stuff. They're attenuated by other stuff. But we'll talk about this, because what happens is this is a crucial piece of differentiating, for example, accelerations from astrophysics models to the decay of high-energy things. So, you know, photon is what you get from almost every early universe decay, relics and so forth. And a proton is what you get for most accelerators in astrophysics. So once we determine that, we should be able to know if it's new physics or if it's new astrophysics.
Once you determine what the events are.
Yeah.
But the protons could have been formed along the way by photons.
Okay, so you're making a model already. Let's go to that. First, let me do more things. Let's look at this blue line for a little bit before we get into the models. The blue line is gotten, actually, the way, this is an Agassiz plot, okay? So the way they did it, they put, as you can see, a bend here, which is one component falling down and another component coming up, and then being killed by the microwave background. Now, the way this works is, let me do this really 101 just for fun, because I took the trouble of drawing all these things. So let's take all the galaxies around ours. Ours are always sort of, you know, in that shaped. And the thing is, it looks like we have more blue galaxies, but the volume, since I'm doing two dimensions, the volume is a lot bigger for the yellow ones. So the flux of the yellow galaxies is a lot higher than the flux of the blue galaxies. Okay? So here's our flux. And here's all color-coordinated spectra. So here's, you know, the yellow ones are higher and so forth. So a source that's nearby, like the blue ones, will not be killed. But the sources which are either yellow, orange, and green will be killed, right? So the volume is higher. It's volume, right? Yeah, no, I'm just saying, if you take the first piece and then the other piece, the volume of the second piece is much bigger. I'm not doing by DL or DR. I'm just saying the total contribution.
What's the difference between yellow and
orange? Nothing. I'm just putting... Okay, this is really the 101 taken apart, right? No, okay, so I'll show you a real calculation in a second. I just want a guess, okay? Okay. No, my only point of doing this exercise is that the blue is not killed, okay? And the blue is lower flux. That's all I want. So that there is something here that will not be killed, and there's going to be a bump. So if it's something local, it's going to survive. Now, which means the following. If you put an overdensity where we are, so suppose there's something special about these accelerators and they seem to cluster around us, then you can actually get around this thing. So here's the plot of that conclusion, okay, which is the following. You have, this is the same, or our version, this is our calculation with the one power spectrum put in, gamma of 3, minus 3, and the e to minus 3, that piles up because of the GZK cutoff and then dies off, and this is a uniform distribution. If you put an overdensity, very silly, you just say it's 10 times more dense around, let's say, what did we put here, 20 megaparsecs around us, then you sure enough start stretching this thing so you could in principle reach where the data is. Okay, so it could be something that is within 20 megaparsecs.
Isn't that constrained by CMB, right?
Actually, it's constrained, at these scales, it's constrained by things like that, right? So this is, for example, upside down version of the CFA survey. I come from Brazil, so I should put it this way. anyway, and so we have some idea of what the overdensity is locally. And it turns out it's not 10 or 30, it's about 2. Okay? Good question. Here? No, let me tell you. This must, let's turn it around. This is Como over here. And Virgo should be, yeah. So it's halfway to this point.
There.
No, that is something else. That's Coma, which is too far. So the way you do this, and I don't know, maybe this is too much detail, but the way we do this is we have to look for galaxies. This is the number, this is how CFA and the PSCZ catalogs are done. You have redshift, and you have what the number of galaxies are, and they fluctuate around, let's say, this dashed line, which is the model for what a homogeneous distribution would look like. Okay? So if you put the difference between this and that, so the difference between the solid line and the dashed line, then you know what your overdensity is, and here's the result given two things. The overdensity distribution and the fact that the prime production is not a continuous process. If there's you draw the dice if you made a pion or not when you are within, say, 50 megaparsecs, right? So it's not, so basically the flux over here, it's not zero, but it's half a pion production event or a third of one and so forth. So for the agassiz, so what we did was the following. We say, okay, let's normalize, let's just say there is a input power spectrum of gamma of 3, and normalize it by saying there's about 728 events above 10 to the 19. What is the probability of finding things above 10 to the 20? Okay, so we normalize by integrating all the events over here. This is the data, and this is the shaded region, what you expect for a gamma of 3, okay? Including all the overdensities and so forth. So you still have a big departure. But if you say, well, let's do something more radical and say the input spectrum is gamma of 2.1, say, or 2. Okay, so you just make a much harder source. Then you can reach closer to the data, but of course you don't explain these guys. So you would have to make a model in which there's something happening here that dies off, does whatever it has to do, and goes away, and then something new that comes in. So even if it is a astrophysical, say, model of gamma of 2, it's a new source. Okay. And as you make the source harder and harder, you get closer and closer. This is the mean of the same thing. So the mean for gamma of 1.5 is reaching closer, and with the spread due to the Agassiz number of events, you still can't tell. So maybe it is the fact that there is a very hard spectrum to begin with. But let's talk about models. So what could explain these things? So the things you want to do if you want to make a model, first thing, you have to reach the energy. So you want to do something that gets to 10 to the 20 electron volts. Second, you want fluxes, which are a particle per kilometer squared per century. You want the spectrum to be, who knows, maybe it's a new thing coming in. So it could be, you know, either minus 2, either minus 1, something hard. The cosmography, as I showed you in that distribution of points, it doesn't look like it's coming from the galaxy. It doesn't look like there's any over, more events in the local group, say, you know, Andromeda direction and so forth. But maybe it could be the halo of the galaxy. So when you see one of the proposals is that it's dark matter decay, and if it's dark matter decay, it would be isotropic to the level of what we've seen so far. Eventually, we should see an anisotropy. Local superclusters and the closest AGNs, the active galactic nuclei. So things like that we know, the local supercluster and the AGNs, do not correlate well with the distribution of these points. These seem to be uncorrelated. The composition we discussed before is muon, or the depth of the shower maximum. So the fly's eye event, people believe it's a proton or iron, not a photon, but it's one event. So we need more to know about this one. And Agassiz, the trend is unclear. It's really, they've talked about it, but never really been able to derive a composition. And there might be these clusterings. There might be these triplets and doublets, which would be quite intriguing. But keep in mind that the clustering there is when you mix from 5 times 10 to the 19 upwards, and now you're mixing maybe apples and oranges if your spectrum is two different things. So you have to know where to cut to know what you're looking at. And the people have come up with two different approaches, the outer space one. So the first thing to know, which is the reason I am interested in this field, is that no model fits all the data. So that's kind of fun. It's a rare event these days. The only way you can make them fit from time to time is to find a miracle magnetic field. Okay, so you do something with the magnetic field to do just what you want, and you see some examples of that. And so this is mostly true for the outer space. It's mostly true in general, but for the outer space models, which what I mean by outer space is use known physics and astrophysics and throw away some of the data or invent a new magnetic field. And that's the bottom-up idea. So you really have an accelerator somewhere that is getting to these energies. And the other one is be more free in your imagination. Start from the top and decay down. So the energy is a piece of cake. You start at, you know, who knows, gut scale or whatever is most fashionable. I guess TEV doesn't do the trick, but oh well. Walk up and take the ski lift and come down from the top. Okay, so let's look at my first impression when I thought about this problem is that, boy, there must be tons of astrophysical accelerators out there. How am I going to do this? You know, how are we going to be figuring out which ones have any chance? The good news is that there aren't that many that you could even start to think about. So energies are really high. This is the real challenge. And the other challenge is the propagation, because as I showed you, the spectrum is always going to give you this peak. So if you distribute it like normal stuff, it's going to give you the peak again. So you're trying to make it something a little bit different than normal stuff. But there's one thing that about accelerators which are nice, that is they usually try to contain their particles inside the accelerator, right? So when I was a postdoc at Fermilab, I was pleased to know that they keep the particles in the accelerator. So this is something astrophysical accelerators should do also. And what you do by asking that simple question is say, let's put a plot of magnetic field versus size of whatever object you happen to, you know, imagine could do the trick, and ask what would contain a particle of 10 to the 20 electron volts, right? So this you can, there's going to be a lot of astrophysical stuff down here, but there are very few things that reach this dashed line, which is the protons at 10 to the 20. And if you take seriously the 3 times 10 to the 20, then you need even a little more. So as you can see, only the orange things reach that line. So you think about small things like neutron stars with high magnetic fields, active galactic nuclei, so galaxies with big black holes in the center spewing out stuff right in the middle here, radio lobes which come from active galactic nuclei, and galaxy clusters are things that might reach, at least might contain them. The problem with galaxy clusters, as we'll see, they contain it too much, so they don't make it here. So neutron stars is one of my favorite topics from time to time. And what we did, and you don't want to go through all this stuff, but what we did was to look at, you know, losses in the neutron stars and how you could probably have young neutron star winds do the trick. You can reach 10 to the 21 in these winds in principle, at least from the back of the envelope approach. And one of the nice things about it would be that for neutron stars, it could have a very flat spectrum, an e to the minus 1, so very hard spectrum, which is something you need for new components. But the composition better be iron, because we're talking about neutron stars in the galaxy that don't look like the galaxy. So they look isotropic. It better be iron turning around. But that's no problem, because neutron stars have a lot of iron. So the story here is the following, that you can imagine a neutron star. If you try to accelerate things very close to where the pulsar emissions mechanisms is like, you have way too much photons around this region. But you know that this is a 10-kilometer thing of densities of nuclear matter, and this magnetic dipole field that we usually assume to be there to first approximation has not a vacuum around, so you have a lot of plasma that's co-rotating with this object. And as this co-rotation radius reaches the speed of light, so if you keep thinking that things will co-rotate, eventually you have to stop this story, so that the magnetic field with the plasma will look like something like this. And eventually you can think that, at least we think, that there's a lot of plasma being accelerated that way. It seems to be true for at least E plus E minuses. And the question is, can you have enough iron co-rotating in these, well, not co-rotating, but expanding with huge gamma factors from these winds that could do the trick for the ultra-energy cosmic rays? And in terms of energetics, it works for the following ranges in magnetic field and spin rates. So you would have to be spinning very fast. So it would have to be very young neutron stars. When they spin down, then the energy to do all the stuff goes away. And they have to have magnetic fields within 0.1 to, say, 10 to the 14. This is 10 to the 13 units, so 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 14 Gauss. So these are pretty reasonable neutron star magnetic fields. These are the magnetars over here. And the ones which are with the highest magnetic fields, they spin down too fast to actually have the iron that's been ejected, say, in the supernova, at this wind, just after supernova, actually go through the supernova envelope. So there is a possibility, and one of the nice things about doing iron is that iron versus protons, this is a plot, again, of a galactic coordinate system in which the squares are protons and the crosses are iron. And you can see that the protons, both of them were emitted from the galaxy, and the protons are arriving where they came from, the galaxy. The iron is all over the map. Okay, so that's why this is a possibility. The second one on that list would be the black holes in the centers of active galaxies. And the problem there is that a lot of galaxies seem to have these black holes. Not all of them are active, but a lot of them have the black holes. And if you have very high activity in this galactic, say, the AGN that you're considering, then again, you have a lot of losses due to the photon background. So you're trying to accelerate protons of 10 to the 20 electron volts without destroying it because of all the radiation field around. So these kinds of models have a hard time. But if you look at radio lobes, so the same system, so AGNs, again, have this nucleus region. So the central regions have high energy gamma rays, which tend to destroy your protons, or at least make them lose energy. So the losses are too high. And again, you get the GZK cutoff, because these AGNs are distributed through space, and they will give you a cutoff just like any other astrophysical accelerator we consider outside of the galaxy. Dead quasars were proposed. Again, you get the GZK cutoff. So these are proposals for things that could reach these energies but will not get around the fact that the spectrum doesn't dive. Okay? Radio lobes are an interesting possibility. These are actually one of the best possibilities because, in principle, you have much lower radiation field. These are these big lobes that are formed at the ends of these jets. They have magnetic fields. They're much larger, and they have fewer losses due to the photon background. So again, you have a way to contain these protons and maybe accelerate them. You can reach the energies, and these things are very rare. So again, this one might get around by having something local, for example, M87, which is that picture. So in terms of the spectrum, M87 could be the source of these ultra-high-energy cosmic rays because it's close enough. It's 17 megaparsecs away. So it's not far enough to make all these pions. So it's the blue line in my little 101 spectrum construction. And it's the only one. So the next one will be 80 megaparsecs away. So that would do the trick. The problem is, how does one source in the sky look isotropic, right? So this is the problem with astrophysical proposals in general. That's where the miracle bee comes in. So you say, oh, well, no problem. We invent a magnetic field that does the trick. So here is a picture showing that, yes, there are magnetic fields in almost every galaxy we know of. And so what you need to do some of that, and it's not clear, we are working on trying to show that even that wouldn't work, but it's a wind that keeps an azimuthal kind of bottle so that something coming from one direction goes into this bottle and gets mixed in. Okay, so it's like the end of a Van Allen belt from here to M87. So it's pretty cuckoo stuff, but that's the way to do it. If you really want to do it, that's what we have to do. So I just want to show this example because, you know, we're going to do even cuckooer things by looking at top-down models. But this is as good as it gets as far as astrophysics goes. There's so clusters, I mentioned that they could, in principle, contain these things. The problem is we're not in the middle of a cluster, and the cluster next door would contain it forever, so it wouldn't get here. So it's not too easy to solve it by containing it in that direction, in that sense. And what happens is, since the magnetic fields of the clusters can contain a 10 to the 20, it contains it and it makes pions as it moves around the cluster. So it loses the energy without having to travel that much because it's traveling it in circles instead. Okay, so clusters don't do very well. Gamma ray bursts were proposed because if you just equate the fluxes, it sort of matches, depending on what evolution you have for gamma ray bursts. But they seem to be high redshift things and not very close by. So if you again want to do it with gamma ray bursts, you need to have had a burst in our galaxy. Okay, so we had a burst very close to our galaxy, say 200 years ago. No, much earlier than that. But it got so if you had a burst, say, a long time ago, but it accelerated these things, and say it was close enough, but not that close that it would have all the 10 to the 20 electron volt protons had passed already. So we would see, you know, one mono-energetic event right now, right? So if you had just one gamma ray burst, every 10 to the 20 would get before the 10 to the 19, and so forth. So we're just getting lucky to see the 10 to the 20 electron volt protons. Now, to actually get around this, because then we would see a monoenergetic event, we would have to have magnetic fields again do the trick of spreading them around, so not looking at a hot spot, and taking long enough for the low-energy ones to arrive at the same time as the high-energy ones. So, again, miracle bees. Okay, so let's not take miracle bees, but let me just not go through this, but show you one thing that's important. Zevatrons, which is the astrophysical side, composition is always hadronic. Iron, protons, protons, protons. We have different spectrum, and we have different arrival distributions, and depends on this magnetic field trick and how to test these things. But, you know, keep in mind that it's hadronic. Then you have the top-down approach. And I lost track of time, so I probably should be speeding up even more. Top down, I still have half to go, but oh well. Physics, I'll go faster, but hopefully you will stay awake a little bit. I'll wake you up at the end because it's really interesting. So let's just talk about top down. Top down models, I'll tell you when to wake up. There's tons of fun things that you can propose. Cosmic strings and monopoles, monopole, anti-monopole, cosmic necklaces, vortons, all kinds of different, you know, interesting things. And so I'm putting them all together in one class, and then putting in another class super heavy relics, which are matter-stable, long-lived, that could be dark matter particles. Okay? And the reason I'm just making these two broad brush things, and I won't bother you through, well, let me tell you just a little bit. Sorry, these are heavy. I hate these heavy transparencies, but I make them myself sometimes. Cosmic strings, usually the problem is the following. So you can go through this list if you want. But topological defects, the typical scale is the horizon. So you have one big long string, and it's very unlikely that that will give you the right flux. So the energy is a piece of cake, okay? Because you have energies above 10 to the 20 to begin with. You do something to the string, make it, you know, spread whatever it's contained in itself, and it will be high energy, right? But the flux is usually really, really low because they're too far apart. Monopoles is the opposite of cosmic strings. They're usually too many, but that's why inflation was made to get rid of them. So you usually have to fine-tune it, and even then you don't quite make it. The only way you can do topological defects to do the trick is something like cosmic necklaces and some combination of two symmetry breaking scales. So you have a distance between beads in strings so that the beads can meet each other in some, you know, smaller distances and get close to the flux. But it's really tough. You have to do a lot of gymnastics for that. But super heavy relics, again, the real sort of weak point of that one is that it's not particle physics-wise clear how you would have something live so long to decay now, okay, or too late, to decay with ages longer than the age of the universe. But the good news is that we don't know anything about dark matter, we don't know about these, maybe they're the same things we don't know. So put them together. Now, the important thing about all of these models is that you have photons, a lot more than protons, okay? So the spectrum is photon-dominated. We don't have a power law, it's a QCD fragmentation kind of spectrum, so you always end up with XX bars that decay, eventually make jets and so forth. And you can have two types of distribution. Either you have distant topological defects which are spread homogeneously, say, to first approximation, or you get a halo distribution in the case of the dark matter. And these give generically two types of spectra, which are pretty nice because now you can go and test them. Of course, there's, you know, these, for example, are the spectrum for super heavy relics, okay, super heavy particles decaying in the halo. And since they're in the halo, the spectrum looks pretty much like the spectrum at the source. Okay, there's no GZK for these guys because they're done next door. And you see that the photons are always a lot bigger than the proton spectrum, and here, and they keep going, and they're not a power law, they fall down at the energies of X's and so forth, and here's the data. So it's no problem explaining these if they're gammas, okay? The observers think they're actually protons or iron, but they don't know for sure. So this is still a possibility. If you put these topological defects spread through the universe, the protons are going to decay, okay? So this is the GZK cutoff all over again. And the photons, which were most abundant, also lose a lot of energy, okay? Because there are all kinds of interactions. The difference between the proton interaction, which is the spin production thing, and the photon is interacting with the radio background, and it's always interacting. So it's always losing, the whole flux goes down together, okay? So it's just some line, and it's not clear depending on the backgrounds if it's high or low. But in this case, you would have protons doing the peak, and then photons out here at the end. But these are very hard spectra. And the photons, although they fit over here, they have to be constrained back there. So here's an interesting astrophysics side of the story, which is you're trying to fix a problem at 10 to the 20 electron volts, and you better worry about 10 to the 8, okay? Because here's where Egret says the photon flux is below this bar, okay? So you have to be worried about all the way down. And you see, when you turn this around, this is more or less the background photon. Okay, so what is happening is that, you know, microwave background, infrared, and radio backgrounds are making your photon taking pieces out of your spectrum. So new physics usually has another table with all this information, and photons, 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 and a little bit of protons. Okay, so this is the important part of that story. So we have good signatures from the two approaches, bottom up and top down. Bottom up, you have protons, nuclei, power law spectrum and counterparts, so eventually, or some very interesting magnetic field. And photons is what you expect for the case of top-down models, not a power law spectrum and no counterparts. So you could have, for example, the Hale distribution, which when you have both south and north data, and you can compare the anisotropy of the halo, you should be able to tell if they're distributed like the dark matter. So we need two things, composition and full sky coverage. And that's what the experiments are going to do. I think I... Does it end in like 10 minutes? Okay. So one project I'm very sort of involved in and happy about is the Pierre Roger project, which is building one array in Argentina and wants to build another one in Utah as soon as that one is done. This array would be, instead of the 107 kilometers square that I showed you for the Agassiz array, we would have 3,000 kilometers square. Plus four fluorescence detectors. Okay, so you would have both the shower, the array in the ground, plus the shower as it develops in the atmosphere. The thing about fluorescence detectors is that it's a beautiful technique, but it only works in moonless nights, dark nights, and no clouds and so forth, 10% of the time. So the numbers game is much better done with the ground array, but to have both is really wonderful, because if you have, you know, some showers, you can calibrate both things, and then you can use the statistics of the ground arrays. So they should get about 60 events a year above 10 to the 20. And the one thing I wanted to wake you guys up about is horizontal showers of ultra-energy neutrinos. But I'll tell you when to wake up again. Just to show you what Auger could do in 3 years, now that whole shaded region has collapsed to a much smaller shaded region because we have a much higher statistics. That's the only gain. And you want to fill the pampas of Argentina with 3,000 kilometers square of detectors, 1,600 of them. You want them to be very self-sufficient because you don't want to go service them. And you don't want to wire the whole country to do that either, because that nobody would fund that. So what we do is have some self sort of very independent units, which measure everything with solar power and a little battery, and then transmit it through this antenna to talk to each other and figure out when something happens. So in principle, the tank, you see. So this is, you know, the fly's eye kind of, this is a shower seen by the fly's eye and at the same time by the ground array. This is what it would look like in Utah. And this is where it is being built right now. There are some mountains over here, the Andes. Okay, so you can go skiing on your spare time. And this is what the array looks like. Right now, as we speak, they're building this red part of the array, which is called the engineering array, where they're going to test everything, make sure it works, and then multiply it by many factors to make the whole thing work. This is all the collaboration. It's all over the world. Oh, and for our French friends, this is how big Paris is compared to the array. In this game, size matters, by the way. This is in Brazil, the tanks being loaded, so your answer. You can recognize it, maybe. It's not too far from where your parents are. And then they got stuck in the barter, and we almost started another Brazil-Argentina war, but they eventually got to Argentina. There they are. And the first one is taking a picture with all the guys, making sure it works. So it worked. And this is Priscilla, the queen of the desert. I always wait to see how many people saw the film. The funny thing, most of the people in the collaboration hadn't seen. So Jim Cronin was very surprised when I told him who Priscilla was. And this is this is a satellite picture of the area where the array is being built. And these yellow little boxes are where all the tanks for the engineering array are. Okay, now you can wake up. Ultra-energy neutrinos. So not only I'm hoping that this, so the bottom line before you know you guys wake up again is that the Auger should be able to help quite a bit figuring out what this mystery is, if they're photons or protons, and if they are you know, really continuing this spectrum or having a cutoff. Okay? Now, another thing it will do, which is sort of for free to some level, is that neutrinos can make showers in these things, sort of. So if you look at the atmosphere this way, it is 36 times bigger that way. So most showers we detect are coming in the vertical. Okay, so proton showers have some angle that they do, but if they let's say you take the same proton shower at 10 to the 20 that you saw coming above your head and do it this way. What happens is it will be over way out there, and by the time it gets to you, there won't be any shower left. Okay, the whole development would be over. You would have a little bit of muons that keep coming, but it's a very short pulse of muons. It's very easy to tell. Now, if you have a shower that develops on top of you coming from the horizontal, it's something else. It has a different cross-section. Okay, it's not a hadronic cross-section. So if you observe something like this, then you know, depending on the angle, that the cross-section better be weaker than that of hadrons. And if you think, okay, so if there are neutrino sources out there, we should be able to see them very easily, depending on their cross-section, interacting on top of us. Actually, there are two ways you could see them. One is by the fact that the cross-section, depending on your detector, might be a little bit above the standard model, and I'll show you how a little bit what that means in terms of how much above the standard model it has to be. The other thing that it does is if you have neutrino sources with the standard model picture, it will, from time to time, come from lower down and hit the Earth, and will make taus on the Earth or in the Andes. And these taus have such a lifetime that it would, again, start a shower on top of you. So it's kind of nice that you can have tau decay and observe that as a horizontal shower. Now, do you have the neutrinos to do the trick? And yes, you do, because when you make the pions, the whole GZK story is pion production of high-energy protons. You get a bunch of neutrinos, because you have the pions to make the neutrinos. So you have about, you know, when you go in megaparsecs for an energy of 10 to the 20 versus an energy of 10 to the 19, for each, this is the number of neutrinos per proton. So it's about 6 to 8 neutrinos per proton when you reach these highest energies. So we have the flux, and what happens is if, say, let me show you the cross-section. I'm supposed to be finishing now. So this is the standard model cross-section. You know this one since you were in kindergarten, right? So you have energies over here, and this is what this dark black line does for the standard model cross-section. What happens with, say, you imagine there are extra dimensions as 2 TeV, and you do some back-of-the-envelope wrong, but back-of-the-envelope estimate of how high a cross-section could get for neutrinos, it will start deviating from the standard model about TeVs, and then you keep on going, it will deviate. Now, with Fly's eye, you reach over here in terms of, given the flux we think is there because of the GZK protons, how many of these neutrinos... So you do the following. You say, how many horizontal showers you saw? Answer, zero. How long did you look? So forth, right? What's the flux you expect? The flux you expect is the one tricky part in the astrophysics game. And that has to do with, again, if these neutrinos are being produced due to GZK cutoff. So you say, well, if we have the same sort of spectrum of protons, we would expect X amount of neutrinos. Okay. Then you say, we didn't see any. So the cross-section of neutrinos better be below these diamonds here. So that's no big deal because the standard model thinks it's down here. With Auger, we should be able to get there. So it means that depending on the energy, and that the energy dependence has to do with the flux of these neutrinos, okay? So depending on the energy, you would reach very close to the standard model, which means anything that gives you a little bit more cross-section for neutrinos at 10 to the 19 should be able to be constrained, which is kind of cool, okay? And with the taus, it's going to be a similar thing. And I won't go through this busy thing, but basically you would have 3 tau events per year in Auger. Depending on, these are different fluxes of GZK neutrinos, AGN neutrinos, and topological defect proposals of neutrinos. And this is the range that Auger can see, so it would definitely reach these GZK neutrinos if they see the tau decay on top. So, and there's one more thing, I know I ran out of time, but let's say a wish. This is my wish for in the future, we'll be here. So now we know that there is a GZK cutoff and there's something new. So there's new physics and there's extragalactic protons doing exactly what we expected them to do. Then one thing you get for free is the fact that you're probing Lorentz invariance at gammas of 10 to the 11, right? So just for fun, if the protons would do exactly what we thought, we would know that Lorentz invariance works to the level of gamma of 10 to the 11. Now, to continue on this horizontal showers business, the next frontier would be something like USO, OWL, or AirWatch, which is the idea that instead of doing the fluorescence from Earth looking up in the atmosphere, you go up and you look down, and now you can use the whole big atmosphere that is in the dark during some time and look down at these showers. So I think the future is kind of interesting because we'll have maybe these projects in the very long term, but for certain, I think a few years, we should have a workshop at ITP on all the ultra-energy cosmic rays that Auger will be seeing. Thank you. Yeah. The ILSO actually is a European proposal to put not exactly this picture, but in the International Space Station, an experiment there, which is not as high as one would like eventually, but it's really good already because it should be starting to look down and see what we can see. So, yeah, I think it's going to happen one day. I hope to be around.
Why can't you look for the GZK muons?
The GZK muons, meaning, oh. The neutrinos that I'm getting, why don't I look at the muons coming from them too? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. I don't know the good answer to that. I imagine that's a good question. There are many muons out there. The problem is, can you tell them apart? Right. Yeah. Probably. Yeah, it's a very boring shower by comparison.
A single charged particle, that's pretty hard. I don't know, if you get a muons of that kind of energy, you might get tau.
Yeah, I think so. I think you should.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Does Auger increase your ability to distinguish primary?
It helps because it both, well, sort of. It helps in the fluorescence case, right? So the shower development, so we need two things. We need to know what the shower development looks like, which the fluorescence detectors do much better, but we need a lot of events, which the ground arrays do much better. So they're going to have both. They don't have the muon detectors on the ground that Agassiz showed to be not the right way to do this. And the detectors you actually can measure muons in these detectors because of just the pulse of, you know, you flash, the muon goes through and it flashes, and then if, you know, you actually measure the amount of stuff in a tank by the number of equivalent muons, and they have a little bit of a different timing between muons and electrons. So in principle, you can even try to get the muons, but it's very tough. I think it's easier to see the shower development as compositions. How what? I think it. Well, first they are hadron to begin with, but that's not the big difference. That's the few extra. I think it's because of the way they interact with the atmosphere is the, you know, the point of where they start.
So you mentioned Lorentzian very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. What's the status of this Coleman-Glashow proposal, the Lorentzian?
Yeah. So if you turn around my wish, which is suppose instead of seeing what you expected. This peak that should be there is not there because there's a difference for a gamma. You know, when you are at Lorentz gammas of 10 to the 11, I used too many gammas in the same talk, but anyway, when you're 10 to the 11, maybe the biomass is shifted. So this thing should happen there instead, right? So that's their proposal, that maybe the reason why we're seeing is because it's not Lorentz invariant in this, to this level. And so, there are a few papers written on this, and I think it's interesting because the threshold really helps, right? The fact that, because in principle, this should be true to everything, all the losses, all the other photon losses. But the biomass really helps by having, you know, something that wasn't there to begin with.
Question. Can you remind me again, for the thermal measurements, how do you really know your energy?
So the calorimetry and the fluorescence detectors are just, you add all these things up, right?
But how do you get a calibration? How do you know where center
of
the point is?
Good question. So, I don't know the answer. I know the following, that you can cross-calibrate, and high-resolution fly's eyes having this problem right now, trying to see where they are. And so, if you take piece by piece, everybody matches, right? So, because each array of these, as you build these big arrays, you don't see the low-energy guys. You have to really, you know where your low-energy joins in with everybody else's. So this is the tricky part, is where do you bend, right? I mean, you blend the things. But according to Jim Cronin, which I trust, they all seem to be okay, in the sense that he actually looked at every single experiment and how the spectrum looked like. You have one feature which helps, which is this little dip over here, if you believe it's there. You know, it's significant within the error bars. And here it's, you know, thousands and thousands of events. It's not the same problem over there. This is log scale EQ. So I think if you have this feature over there, which seems that all experiments see it, then it's not so hard. But without the feature, it's tough. Yeah, if you have something designed just here, I have no idea how to do it. Aside from looking at simulations and, you know, trusting them. You need a factor, so the data, I don't have, whoops, over here, but you need a factor of 10, would be good.
Mm-hmm. So then it gets a little more
tricky. Yeah, it's not so bad. Yeah, in the log you can do a few, and that's the. Yeah, so we might have a bad surprise, or at least, you know, prove the Lorentz invariance works for 10 to the 11. You could count. That would be good. But you know, the whole point is we don't. So let's use what we have, right?
Other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker again.